brought to you by Burr and Foreman, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's time for Results Matter Radio, where we bring you pertinent business information and offer real-life solutions to help drive desired results for you, whatever your business may be. Now, here are your hosts, Elizabeth Gordon and Lee Cantor.
Elizabeth Gordon, but I've pulled a bit of a switcheroo on you, and I've got Stone Payton here with me this morning. Stone, good morning. How are you?
Well, good morning, Sunshine. I am doing well. Thanks for letting me play. You know, Lee Cantor, he's AWOL. He's out in San Francisco.
Having a good time, I'm sure.
I think he's doing wine country while we're in here in the salt mines doing the hard work.
That is a good time. Lucky him. Well, we do have a full studio here this morning and a great show planned for you all. Don Mueller is here, the executive director of Marcus Autism Center, and Anise Castleberry, the director of Walk Now for Autism Speaks and Events in Georgia. Latasha Stevens is the executive director of Autism Society of America, the Georgia chapter. Britton Page of Ballantyne and Jim McCartan of Burr Foreman.
That's a basketball team.
It is. I mean,
that's a full compliment. How did you get all those people in the studio?
Well, you know, it's Autism Awareness Month, and so we're doing a special broadcast to talk about the issue of autism and approach it from multiple perspectives, because there's so many different aspects to working with a child in the autism spectrum, I believe is the appropriate way to talk about it, but I'll be corrected by our experts in the studio in a moment. And so I'm glad that we've got a room full of experts to tell us a little bit more about the issue at hand. So Anise Castleberry of Autism Speaks, welcome to the studio.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Talk a little bit about how you got involved in Autism Speaks.
Well, I am a psychology major, and I've been working in a nonprofit for quite a while. I was with March of Dimes, and I had a great passion, of course, for that organization and working with babies, but had an opportunity to come with Autism Speaks last July and realized this is where my true passion lies. Goes back to my college days and learning about life development, and just means a lot for me to be here working with the organization.
Now, Anise, the prevalence of autism in Georgia, how widespread of a issue is this and the effects?
Well, just last Thursday, on March the 29th, the CDC released the most recent numbers indicating that nationwide the numbers have really, really increased dramatically. They're very staggering numbers. 1 in 88 children are now diagnosed on the spectrum. 1 in 54 boys in Georgia, and 1 in 252 girls. So there is a distinct difference there, but the prevalence rate is just increasing astronomically, and we've got to do something about this.
And what do we need to do about it? I mean, what are some of the things that need to take place in order to deal with the situation?
Well, there's a lot of things to be identified, a lot of unknowns. We are working hard every day at Autism Speaks to fund research, to find answers to some of the questions that I'm sure are going to come up in the topic of conversation today. We need to find out why it's happening, why it's increasing so much, what we can do to slow it down, how we can treat it better, just numerous things that we can do to change the situation.
So forgive me if this question is a little bit inelegant, but I think there's probably listeners out there that have that same question. Is this a disease? Is it a condition? Is it environmental? Is it genetic? What exactly is autism?
Well, we think it's a combination of both environmental and genetic. Those are things that our research is determining now. So that's the problem. We just don't know exactly what it is. Some of the things that we have done, and I'm sure Don will address in his conversation, we are finding ways to identify it earlier. We think if we can have early treatment, we're going to have more success. So right now, our key to success seems to lie in early intervention.
And that's a perfect segue, I think, to bring Don into the conversation here. What does the Marcus Autism Center do?
Well, the Marcus Autism Center is the largest clinical care entity in the country treating children with autism and related disorders. Last year, we saw 5,676 individual children from around the state, around the Southeast, and really around the world. So we provide diagnostic services, helping families understand where their children have strengths and weaknesses, along with treatment planning. And then we have many treatment programs that range from skill acquisition, teaching children how to speak, helping children with feeding difficulties, and then helping the children who have severe behavior, which is sometimes a negative effect of autism.
And Anise, what is it like for real people behind all of these numbers that are dealing with autism on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I do not have a child affected by autism, so I think that I, as an observer, am very fortunate to be able to recognize just what they go through on a daily basis. As a mom, I think in life I always look at things from a mom first, and when I see parents who I hear say that they never have heard their child tell them they love them or their child doesn't communicate appropriately, I realize that their dreams and hopes for their children have been just banished, it seems like. And to me, that's very devastating. So I see that on a daily basis. I hear parents talk about what it's like for their children not to eat or to hear how it is when their children misbehave during school. When a parent is trying to work and they receive a telephone call and there are no available babysitters that might could help them with the situation, not to mention the financial devastation that it imposes on many families. I have received phone calls from men in tears, which almost brings me to tears now just saying that, talking about how much they've invested in their five-year-old child, their life savings, maybe a 32-year-old man who's fortunate enough to have saved $50,000-$70,000 from whatever means has been wiped away. So for the real families, it's financially devastating, emotionally devastating, just more than most of us know.
And how does this manifest itself? Is there a correlation to IQ higher or lower, or is it more social skills, or does it just depend on the individual?
Well, it is a spectrum, and I hear the saying often at Autism Speaks, if you know a child on the spectrum, you know one child on the spectrum. So yeah. It could be they could be impaired intellectually. When they are impaired intellectually, the costs are much greater,
right?
Because it's a financial investment for a lifetime, not a lot of opportunity to change their behavior, to change their learning skills. So it just depends on the individual.
Now, Jim, you've been involved in the issue of autism on both a professional as well as a personal level.
That's correct.
Talk about some of the things that you've seen as you work with clients that are dealing with an autistic child.
Well, you know, when working with families, you have to really focus on what's going on currently. And as a planner, what happens when mom or dad, and it could be either, passes away? And they can pass away, as we all know, at any point in time. You know, that proverbial truck can hit anybody, you know, in their 30s, in their 50s, in their 70s. And one of the things that I am seeing as a professional is more and more meeting with families who mom may be 70, dad may be 75, and they are still the primary caregiver for their child who is now in their 40s, 50s, in some cases even 60s, and dealing with autism. And so, you know, the whole aspect of care, of support for that child, of ensuring that if it's a high-functioning child, that that child has the ability to live and be a productive citizen in life. If they're working at Publix or they're working at one of the other employers that do a wonderful job with our community, that's a whole different aspect of planning than what we normally work with when we're doing what is traditionally called estate planning for our clients. So it's the entire spectrum again.
So the legal and the financial picture changes dramatically
absolutely.
The traditional way that you plan for the future. Let's bring Britton Prigge into the conversation now. Britton's the director of client relationships at the investment advisory firm Ballantyne. And I'm sure you've dealt with this situation with clients as well, where traditional financial planning kind of goes out the window and you've got to start with a whole different set of assumptions.
It is. I think I'll echo what Anise says. I come at this as a mother first, and then the financial aspects and what we can do to help. What I have found overwhelmingly is that there is so much bad information. It doesn't, you know, the disabilities don't discriminate based on socioeconomic status. And I think a lot of wealthy people believe that they can buy their way into some of these programs that could be critical for their children, and that's just not the case. So I think more than anything else, you must be informed and get good advice from somebody like a Jim or a Kristen Lewis or somebody at Smith Gambrell that understand these special needs individuals and understand what they need. Many traditional estate planning groups are not given the best advice.
So let me ask something of all of you, of the group here. What services exist for children in Atlanta, that children and adults, really, that are on the autism spectrum?
Well, to put this into some perspective, if you were to just Google autism cures right now, you would get literally hundreds of cures that are out there. And one of the things we try to do at the Marcus Autism Center is help parents realize what they're dealing with. This is a lifelong disability that they're going to deal with over many, many, many years, and there's not a quick fix. So everybody's looking for a silver bullet, and the best we know today, that doesn't exist. What we try to tell parents is, first and foremost, this is a medical condition, and you need to start just as you would with any medical condition, and that's working with your pediatrician to help really put together a plan for evidence-based outcomes care. The worst thing that can happen to a family is they go and spend literally hundreds of thousands of dollars on things that are not proven in science. And then they're at the end of the road. They have no money. Their child has seen no benefit. You know, the annual cost of autism to our society is well in excess of $60 billion. And we know that we can reduce that cost by early intervention. So the key is to work with your pediatrician when you know something's wrong, spot it early, and really begin those early interventions as soon as possible.
And Britton, you had a statistic about the cost of dealing with an individual with autism.
From what we read, it could be up to $3.2 million throughout a child's life. And firsthand, I've seen that. One of my dearest friends, who's also the director of marketing at Ballantyne, has three children who are on the autism spectrum. And I have watched financially how difficult that can be. I think he probably chooses not to add it up.
Right. Sometimes it's easier that way. Latasha Stevens, I want to bring you into the conversation as well. You're with the Autism Society of America, the Georgia chapter of the National Society of America. What's your relationship to autism?
Sure. As the executive director, my experience with autism started with my son. It's not necessarily a path that a parent chooses to take, but I found myself in a group that I had not initially planned to be a part of, but loving my children, one, you know, as I do with them all, embraced autism and had to figure out what that meant. I am an Okie originally. I'm not necessarily from Muskogee, but born and raised in Oklahoma, and knew there was something different with my child from the time he was born. After getting a diagnosis, which took us to third grade, we moved to the state of Georgia. And in doing so, I knew there had to be several organizations moving to a metropolitan city that I could connect to, and reached out to the Autism Society. And at that time, just really started to embrace support groups, resources in my community, which over the course of several years led me to an executive position. So initially it was being a parent, but now it's both professionally and a parent in coming to the Autism Society.
And how important is it to connect with others who are going through the same thing and hook up with some of these groups and leverage the resources that are available?
Well, I think first and foremost, our objective is the same. And we all want services for our families when we see them either at 22 months or 22 years of age or older. We want to help that family who has been providing care since birth of that child. And as Jim stated, we as well get those phone calls of what to do. My parent is aging. I'm a sibling that lives in another state. My sibling has transition issues and is not open to moving to another state. What do I do? In helping them find those resources, or a newly diagnosed family who says, you know, a teacher has been calling repeatedly and said that my child may be on the spectrum. Where do I go to get resources or a diagnosis? At the Autism Society, we get all of those questions, and some that I don't think we anticipate getting. But being a resource office, we help those families to connect with the Marcus Center, with Emory, wherever they may be in the state of Georgia, if they need a support group, if they are looking for therapy, and they are not in the metro area, what resources are available. That's where we come in and help make that connection or bridge that gap.
Now, Don, there's some exciting research going on at the Marcus Autism Center right now. Can you tell us about the focus of the research?
Absolutely. We were blessed last year with the recruitment of Dr. Ami Klin. He joined our team January of last year. And with him, we've recruited several other PhD and fellow researchers to really take the largest pediatric autism population in the country and start doing the evidence-based research that needs to happen to move the field forward. Some of the work we're doing really focuses on early diagnostics and when can we really see a child developing autism. I use the term developing autism because today you can diagnose a child through behavioral observation. So what that means is you have a qualified technician sitting in a room interacting with the child, observing behavior. What we're learning through our research is that autism is actually starting in the first days of life and it's manifesting over time. It's not something that just happens when the child turns two or three. It's just that that's when the behaviors become first absent. You first notice your child's not recognizing their name. You first notice the child's not speaking or the child has repetitive motion. That's when those behaviors start. You can observe
but
them.
But it's been there in the background all along. It's just now it's become apparent.
Absolutely.
At what age do people typically diagnose formally the condition?
The American Academy of Pediatrics is asking pediatricians to begin screening for autism as young as 18 months. So at 18 and 24 months during well baby visits, they're screening their children. What we hear, very similar to what you've heard today, is the parents know something's wrong. So the parents are usually the first ones that say, you know, I knew something was wrong with my child, but the pediatrician said, let's just wait. It's just a boy. He'll begin speaking earlier. That's a red flag for me. Anytime you know something's wrong, seek guidance. There's lots of great resources available. The CDC has great information on knowing what signs to look for. Share that information with your physician and really become the advocate for your child.
And Anise, you said earlier there are some things that people can do to help in terms of the cutting-edge research going on in Georgia. What would you recommend people do to reach out and become involved?
Well, at Autism Speaks, we're dedicated to funding global biomedical research into the causes, preventions, and treatments. And we partner with Marcus Autism Center to raise funds. We have a walk coming up on May the 20th, Walk Now for Autism Speaks. And we certainly need your support. Half the funds that we raise, we share with the Marcus Autism Center. And that is a result of our relationship with Bernie Marcus and, of course, the wonderful things that are going on at the Marcus Autism Center. So we would encourage everyone to give us a call, look us up on the Internet, get involved with our organization, and raise some funds so that we can fund this critical research.
And we talked a little bit earlier about the legal and financial ramifications for dealing with autism. Britton, can you talk a bit about the financial planning aspect in terms of putting together an appropriate trust to that's going to take care of your child?
Sure. First, I'll say you must have advocates that understand the issues and rules. It's very important to surround yourself with a team initially. I've learned a lot about what they call a life care planner, which usually has a medical background. And you start with that person because they understand the programs and services available in your particular area with your child's particular disability. That planner can come up with a plan for everybody to follow that has an estimate of costs, which forms the foundation for the financial plan. So you really have to start with that. I will say what I've learned is that the biggest mistake I think attorneys often at bad advice that they give is to disinherit a child. And I think that the reason they do that is because there are needs-based programs which will only benefit if you are under a certain income level, and I think that's about $2,000. Instead, I think it's better to create a special needs trust. And as Jim is advocating, many attorneys specialize in these special needs trusts. They understand how to write them. It's just not a one-liner at the end of a will, but it's a vehicle that provides assets from which a disabled child can maintain his quality of life while still remaining eligible for the needs-based program. You can't buy your way into these programs.
Jim, talk a little bit about the special needs trust.
Well, I want to step back because it's important that when you think through planning, that you understand that planning is a lifetime. It's a journey just as every parent has. And when you are talking with families, it's important that they appreciate, and we've talked about the investment the families will make, there's an awful lot of therapies that are not covered under various insurance that are not covered even for high-end insurance. So parents will access that and try to continue to access that to give their child the best chance in life. And what you end up doing is when they turn 18, they've had all these supports generally available to them through the school system, through other avenues, and then they turn 18 and they become adults. And when they become adults, they stand on their own financially with regard to access to public benefits. And so if the family has done planning for the child early, and it's not unusual for me to see a situation where even before the autism diagnosis, they started planning for their child's college, and then they get the autism diagnosis, and they forget that this money has been set aside because it's in the child's name. Well, because that money is in the child's name when he or she turns 18, it can mean that they are not eligible for governmental benefits, the most important of which is Medicaid, because it's the Medicaid then, and in Tennessee we call it 10-care. Working in both Georgia and Tennessee, I can get the two confused, so if I go back and forth, forgive me. But access to the Medicaid-based programs, it can be extremely important for your child. And it may not be immediately. It may be that you need another 10 years to figure out that your child is not going to be successful in the workplace, and then will need access to the governmental benefits. So it really is important that what you do is that you set your child up to have the best opportunity. So it's sort of a planning for the worst, hoping for the best. And planning for the worst is that you leave any inheritance or any gifts for your child in a special needs trust, which is a special type of trust that is treated under federal law and state law as not being a resource that will disqualify them for governmental benefits. So it's ignored for governmental benefit standpoint. And what many lawyers working in the estate planning world do not appreciate is that a traditional spendthrift support trust, the trust that says for the health, education, benefit, and support of my children or grandchildren, is still a resource under public benefit law for that individual. So even though they may not technically be able to touch the money, the government still treats it as theirs.
That they own it.
Looks
like it's a very fine line and very easy to make a mistake while acting in well-meaning.
Absolutely. It's
intention.
You know, I've been a tax nerd my entire career, and I will tell you that the special needs planning, since I had to learn it for myself first, was the most difficult education that I've had. It just turns everything that's traditional financial planning on its head.
Latasha, I saw you nodding your head as Jim was speaking. Have you had experience or watched other parents go through some of those challenges?
Well, of course, personally we have, and as well with our families, like that of Anise with the phone calls that you get. When our son was diagnosed, I was a stay-at-home mom, and with repeated phone calls from the school, felt like we didn't know what to do. Our backs were against the walls. We weren't getting support and didn't know what to ask from the school. Just didn't feel like we were getting a lot of information in terms of what our options were once we had the diagnosis, and chose to do an outside program and really put us in a financial strain. And looking back, would I have done it now? No. Because it, to me, now was a quick fix. It was one of those things that worked at the time. There was no carryover with him. Any child will benefit with a disability or not with one-on-one tutoring. Now he's 17. He probably doesn't even remember having that program. And a lot of our families find with some therapies, and again, I'm not saying this of all therapies, because there are wonderful therapy programs out there for children and adults, but this particular program just did not work for us. And we took a financial hit from that. And families find themselves investing in a therapy that may or may not work. It's kind of the luck of the draw. And I think that's one of the most difficult things about having a child on the spectrum, is that what works for one family may not work at all for another. So you go to a support group meeting, or you talk to friends or family, or someone gives you a referral and has wonderful reviews about a program, and it can be a wonderful program, but just may not be the right fit for your child. So I have to agree with Don in that you have to work with your pediatrician in finding out what is the best way. Be it as reality, that didn't work for us initially. We had to change pediatricians because my pediatrician just was not hearing me. And I had said from the time my child was born, there is something different. And had been with her for many years. I had other children. So I trusted her. I moved when she moved. So I was vested. And if she had said not to give my child something, I would not have done that. So I trusted her for many years. So it did take going into the school and getting those phone calls and just saying, in my gut, something is not right, seeking out different professionals. And unfortunately, none put those clues together. It was a big puzzle, and they all had a piece, but no one pieced that puzzle together until finally I just, through pushing and asking questions, found a place, and again, this was back in Oklahoma, but found a place that was able to not only give us the counseling, both individually but as a family, provide the medical support, and so I wanted a one-stop shop to where I could go and not have to wait weeks and weeks to get a diagnosis. But our families call, and they are looking for resources. They are looking for support. And early diagnosis is I think, the key. But we also have to again, realize that there is a gap of young people and individuals that don't have those supports. So we are playing catch-up with those young adults that are 20, that are 30, that are 40, that said something wasn't quite right many years ago, and, I never got those supports. How do I go forward from this point? And those services just are not there. And as a parent, as an advocate, that is the difficulty when I get that phone call from a parent saying, my child has just graduated or my young person has just graduated and is not able to go into a traditional post-secondary institution, what options are available, but they are not in a situation of needing long-term care. He or she can function, can possibly hold a job, may not drive, but we're in rural Georgia. What options do we have? And the idea of moving to or providing an option in Metro Atlanta just is not an option. That's heartbreaking when you can't find those resources or connect them to resources because of proximity or those services just do not exist. So that's the difficulty and where we are really trying to work with other organizations statewide in trying to fill in those gaps for our families.
Now, Dawn, how should a family go about choosing treatment options? We've mentioned several times the importance of early detection, early diagnosis.
Well, that's a great question. And I think one of the themes I've heard so far spoken about is access to services and how do you pay for that? Because that's the barrier for most treatment. When children are very young, age 0 to 3, there's an organization, Babies Can't Wait. It's a governmental organization that's responsible for helping to get therapies to children. At the Marcus Autism Center, we're trying to partner with these entities to help raise the education, raise the level of training for the providers to make sure that they have the capabilities of getting out there and really helping the kids when they first need it. After the age of 3, they're starting to get into school age, so then the Department of Education becomes involved. And how do we work with the Department of Education to ensure their school teachers and special education teachers are trained to take care of those children? But a lot of this comes back to the question of funding and how is it going to be funding. Here in the state of Georgia, we do not have an insurance mandate, so most insurance companies do not pay for typical evidence-based autism treatments. If this were cancer and your employer or your insurance company said, we're not going to cover cancer for your child, we all would be appalled. Autism is 3 times more prevalent than all childhood cancers combined, but yet most insurance companies don't cover these things today. On the contrary, there are some employers in town who have taken a leadership role, Home Depot, Cisco, Microsoft. These organizations actually have put in place autism benefits. Children's Health Care of Atlanta has a benefit that pays for proven therapies. These are evidence-based therapies that have been proven to show results. As a business person, I would never ask an insurance company to pay for something that's not proven. So your original question was, how do you choose what to do? I think children deserve the best that science has to offer. So I would start with your pediatrician. Start with what's proven in science, start with what's in the peer-reviewed journals, and really figure out where your resources can come from. If your child's very small, get in touch with Babies Can't Wait. If your child's of school age, work with your school district to figure out what services are available there. And as they age, really play towards their strengths. What do they really need? Not every child needs the same thing. Back to your earlier point, each child is an individual, so you must have customized plans. And as they grow older, some children need different types of support. So I think it's working with the child over the long haul to figure out how you accent the positives and help stop the negatives from impeding that child's life.
And the prevalence of autism is growing. I mean, it is real, and it doesn't look like it's something that's going away. So, I mean, those numbers are out there. Why is it on the rise, do you think?
Well, according to our friends down at the CDC, we've seen a 26% increase over the last study that they produced. And so now it's 1 out of every 88 nationally. So 1 out of every 88 children being born, 1 out of every 54 boys being born. Boys are 4 to 5 times more likely to have it than girls. That leads itself to a strong link to genetic predisposition. Not every child who has the genetic predisposition will develop it. Some children develop something that has autism-like characteristics, but not true autism. So genes don't predict who we are or what we become. We build off that to get there. So I think what's important to understand is that probably 50% of the increase could be explained away by people better understanding what autism is. So the way the surveillance study works is they go into communities and they look for signs of autism. When we all grew up, there might be a child who sat in the corner and the teacher would write a note, the child is a funny kid and sits in the corner. Now that same school teacher may write, child lacks eye contact, child lacks social interactions. These are keys for the epidemiologist to pick that child up as a potential case. So they say about half of it could be explained away. The other half, nobody has any idea. And I think the prevalence numbers should be a call to action.
And Anise, as you look at building awareness in the community for the issue, it sounds like it's something that's starting to touch more and more people in society. Have you found that the awareness is growing, that people are becoming more aware that this is an important issue?
Yes, I believe that they are more aware. We have a lot of public service announcements that are seen on television frequently. We're always out in the community sharing our stories, speaking about autism and bringing awareness. We offer, we have services, family services that provide seminars and promote the awareness and allow people to come and learn more about it. So we're out there talking about it every day, getting people to hear what we have to say, just telling our story.
And, I mean, are there bright spots here? We're painting a fairly dim picture. I know there's got to be something that's a more positive spin on the thing. Britton, what are the bright spots that you see as you're working with clients?
You know, I'll say, as I look around this table, and I've heard what Don was speaking about, 1 in 88. I think I've heard that 6 or 7 times in the past several days. To me, the bright spots are awareness. To me, the bright spots are with Don saying an elementary school teacher, as opposed to saying that child's in the corner, will say lacks eye contact, and other parents, and we might understand. I feel like awareness might bring more money and benefits to these people who so desperately need them, because I know that I have, my eyes have been opened, and I hope that I'm one of many.
As a taxpayer, I think it's important that we also look at the cost of having a child, whether it be the disability be autism, whether it be Down syndrome, whether it be mental illness. If somebody hits at age 18 and they become disabled for government benefit standpoint, it costs the taxpayers roughly $3.5 million over that individual's lifetime. So for every child that we're able to hit with early intervention, for every child that we're able to, even if they didn't get early intervention, to do transition work, to be able to help them be productive in life, to have a job, to have the kinds of things that we all want for our kids, we are saving significant dollars. So for every child that, like my daughter, that we can get into the workforce and not put on government benefits, yeah, you may want to structure the financial life so that if they need them, they can get them. But to the extent that we can help them be productive, and we're getting so much better about making transition services available for those who are at transition age, it's important not only for the parents, because I don't want my child sitting at home or sitting in a group home watching TV 24/7. That's not what she wants. And to the extent that we're able to get them out in society, we save significant amounts and thus are able to reduce our deficit, to reduce our tax rates, to save significant dollars. So it really is important that we look at early intervention being best. Catherine missed that, but boy, having the transition services available to make sure she can hold a job, what it takes to hold a job, and help her behavioral challenges work around that, that is tremendous with regard to where she will be as an adult.
What is possible in terms of setting, obviously you set different expectations once it's been established that a child has autism, but what's ultimately, and it's clearly an individual thing based on the unique condition. But
I wouldn't tell you necessarily that all of the expectations are different. Certainly for Catherine, they are different. Catherine presents in a way that she does have some intellectual difficulties. So the intellectual disability, which I think the CDC study says 40% to 50% of kids on the spectrum have, that means 50% don't. So there are many kids on the spectrum who are fully capable of going to college if we can provide them the supports they need to be able to be successful. And those may just be living supports. You know, we are seeing many, many colleges and universities have very special programs. In the area, the University of Tennessee Chattanooga, Vanderbilt, UAB, I don't know if Emory has one yet, but they all have programs that are very specific to help kids with disabilities and challenges be able to go through college and then hold jobs.
Don, I'm sure you've seen some success stories. Would you care to share?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you asked about the bright spots in this. I think the recent CDC study points out that there are more children being diagnosed by the age of three than ever before. And there's been a theme of about early diagnostics and why is that important. The reality is that each and every day we live, our brain changes, and we change in every interaction, and we grow differently. And what's happening with these children is that as they become older, their brains become more hardwired. There's a term called neuroplasticity, and what that means is when you're very young, your brain is kind of mushy. And as you get older, it starts solidifying, and it's why an adult has a hard time learning a foreign language, but a child can learn one relatively easily. So many of the successes happen on these early children. And we have a program at the Marcus Autism Center where 67% of the children come in with zero functional communication. No language, no sign language, no looking at the iPad and pushing a button to try to tell what their wants, needs, and desires are. So the average age in that program is 6 years of age. 100% of the kids leave with some ability to communicate. And if you look at the cost of a child who can speak in society over the long run versus a child who cannot speak, we're not just changing that one child, we're changing the economic future for that family and for society. So I can't overemphasize the importance of getting to these children early. Having said that, many of the older children are very talented, and there are some positive aspects of autism. And one of the things we often talk about is that we can live with autism. What we can't live with are the negative behaviors that develop because of the autism. We can't live with non-verbal, non-communicative attributes. We can't live with severe behavior. But if there are attributes that we can live with, many of these children are extremely focused and much smarter than all of us in this room put together, and very verbal. So there are children who can really succeed and grow into very productive adults. And there are many corporations that are realizing this, and they're actually developing autism benefits as a recruitment tool.
Because it can be something that can be exploited as a skill set, the over a capacity for certain aspects of learning or talent.
Well, and our goal is to make sure these children grow up to be as productive as they can and live out their dreams, not just for their parents, but for themselves. So I think a lot of this, a lot of the successes have to come back to what's right for these children and what do they want out of life. You know, if you have a child who has autism, putting them in timeout is a reward. And it's like the best thing in the world you could do. But as a parent, that's what you do with kids today. You know, it's really understanding each child individually and helping them to develop over their course of their lifetime to make sure they maximize their potential and really try to become productive members of society. But it all comes back to having the resources to provide early intervention and make those things happen.
So as we look at the future, I like to ask all of our guests each week for a results matter tip. And as we've had a great conversation about the issue, it's obviously that affects many people individually and our society as a whole. So I'd like to go around the table now and ask each of you to offer one piece of advice or tip, if you will, for either a parent that's dealing with the issue or somebody who might not be dealing with it personally, but it's still affecting their life. So let's start with you, Anise Castleberry, director of Walk Now for Autism Speaks and Events in Georgia.
Well, it's Latasha said it best, and Britton said it also. You've got to be an advocate for your child. Never give up. Know that other people are not going to fight that battle for you, and it might be a battle. Just continually keep looking for those resources and finding the path that's best for your family.
Excellent. Don Mueller, Executive Director of Marcusum Autism Center, tell us your results matter tip.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't, first of all, thank Bernie Marcus for all the support he has given towards autism. We've got something very special here in Georgia, and it really exists because of his great philanthropy. And I think he said it best. The parents in autism can't be the advocates. They are tired. They are worn down. They don't sleep. These kids are really difficult. So really, it's a plea for the neighbors, for the grandparents, for the brothers, the sisters, the cousins. They have to be the advocates. I would say get involved. Come out to the Autism Speaks Walk, May 20th, Atlantic Station. Show your support. That's not only important because it raises money, it's important because it raises awareness. And when we can sit down with the governor and explain to him that we've had 20,000 people show up on a Sunday morning for a walk, that means something. So I would get involved. I would also challenge people to check with their employers. Does your employer offer an autism benefit today? And if not, why not? Because I really believe it's a good value proposition for the company and for our society, and it's something we need to do more of here in Atlanta with some mandatory insurance benefits.
Nice. Latasha Stevens, next up. Autism Society of America.
I have to echo what everyone else has said, being an advocate and supporting one another, but just that, knowing that you are not alone. So whether it affects you personally, professionally, as a friend, having that support is tremendous. And every parent that has a child on the spectrum has that day. They may have many days, and several months may go by and they do well, and then they have several days that don't go well. But knowing that you are not in this alone, that there are other families that are advocating, that are working together as a support unit, you do have support out there.
Excellent. Jim McCartan, Burr Foreman.
As a parent, it's the not alone. You know, when we got the diagnosis for Catherine, we had 3 to 3.5 years where literally the only thing that my wife and I did was deal with the schools, try to find resources for Catherine, learn more about what autism meant, try to figure out about the different types of medications that we were being recommended to look at. It was phenomenal. It was overwhelming. And you have to find time for yourself as couples. Divorce in this community is extremely it's a very high rate. Some studies will say it's as high as 75%. Of couples with a disabled child. So you have to find time to reconnect as a couple. Excuse me. And you really have to find what you need for your child. So it's connecting with others who have those difficulties in their our communities. The other thing is, don't forget the finances, because they are so important. And you have to work with somebody who understands what public benefits is going to mean to your child. There are many, many good lawyers in the United States and in Atlanta, but if you need to find somebody, there is a group that specializes, and that is the Special Needs Alliance. They are found at specialneedsalliance.org. I am a member. There are a number of other Georgia members. Find somebody who can talk to you about what happens if mom gets hit by that truck. Because if dad's working full time, he's not thinking about what he's going to do for child support if mom is gone.
Thanks, Jim. Britton Prigge, how would you advise people to deal with this very complex and emotional and challenging issue?
Well, you know, it's interesting following Jim and all these people who have such a connection to autism. I look at the financial side and say, that's easy. I can do that. I know how to invest the money. We can do that at Ballantyne. But most important is to understand the issues. Understand, we always say that we're the quarterback for the family or for the client. And we all know somebody. We are all touched, whether we admit it or not, by someone with a disability. And I guess my advice is continue to fight. Continue to make people aware, because it is astounding to me. I believe people are good, and I think that people want to understand. And I think autism is a disability that is becoming front and center. And I think we can all, whether it's financial advisors or benefits or executive directors, we can all help spread the word and continue to fight for these people and the people like Jim and my friend Joe who struggle with this every single day on the financial side and the emotional side continue to fight.
Well, I want to thank all of my guests for such an informative and moving episode of Results Matter. Before we close, I'd like to make sure we give contact information for all of the valuable organizations that you all are here representing. Anise, let's start with you for Autism Speaks. Where can people go online to find out more?
www.autismspeaks.org. You can /Georgia, and it'll take you directly to our page, but the national page will give you the most comprehensive information.
Wonderful. Thank you. Don, how about Marcus Autism Center?
www.marcus.org.
Awesome. And Latasha?
For the Autism Society, ASAGA.com.
Fantastic. Britton Page with Valentine?
It's www.ballantine1l.com, and we actually tweet, and we're on Facebook.
That's wonderful. Great way to connect. Britton Prigge, sorry, I keep mispronouncing your name. And last but not least, Mr. McCartan, where can people go to find out more about?
The law firm is Burr Foreman, and we are found on the web at burr.com, B-U-R-R.com.
Perfect. Thanks, everyone, for a wonderful show. This is Elizabeth Gordon for my fabulous co-host today, Mr. Stone Payton. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Atlanta Business Radio X, and we'll talk to you next week.
This has been a joint production of Burr and Foreman and Business Radio X. Burr and Foreman is a full-service law firm with offices across the Southeast. If results matter to you and you want them to matter to your law firm, please give Burr and Foreman a call at 404-685-4337. For more information and to find the right attorney for you, visit burr.com. That's B-U-R-R.com.